Day two of our vernal equinox retreat here at Tohoma Zen Monastery. We are reading through the Discourse on the Inexhaustible Lamp of the Zen School by Zen Master Tori Inji Zenji, and the commentary by Master Daibi of Unkan. This book that we're using is translated by Yoko Okuda. The sections that we've been reading through have been on the lineage from the historical Buddha through to Hakuin. And being that this text was written by a Dharma heir of Hakuin, it ends at that point with Hakuin. Daibi makes a mention of Tori Inji. And that's as the author of this text, and as the principal Dharma heir of Hakuin. Hakuin had numerous Dharma heirs, but Tori was the one who really continued his lineage, and then Gassan Jito trained under Hakuin and completed his training under Tori, and those two could be seen as the real principal Dharma heirs of Hakuin. They completed his work formalizing the koan system. But we'll get to Hakuin in a moment. We're reading section 43 on page 98 of the text. So let's just get right into the text today. Of the 24 lines of the Zen school, most have lost their transmission. The descendants of Kanzan and old Gudo still survive. Now, when he says the 24 lines of the Zen school, he means that in Japan, there was 24 individual lines established. So these are transmissions from China. Either Chinese masters came to Japan, were established in monasteries and temples in Japan, or more frequently, Japanese monks would go from Japan and train in China, and they would bring it there. And he notes that all of these lines died out earlier in the course of our traversal of the lineage. We looked at, of course, the transmission to Japan, and it's Kanzan that he mentions here, the descendants of Kanzan, the transmission was who went to China and returned, and his lineage persists. And then Dogen Zenji went to Japan, and his lineage persists. So Dogen and Kanzan are the two threads that survived. For those of you that were here when we were discussing that last section in China, the Lin Chi school split into two subgroups. And the yogi lineage is the one that Kanzan was in, and we do chant in our lineage chant for yoga. It's yang qi in Chinese. And that's of the two principal lines of Lin Chi Chan, it's the yang qi line that persist in Japan, but both the Yangqi and the other line, both were transmitted to Japan, and in multiple instances, and did not survive. And presumably, some of the other schools, the old original houses in China, that were still around, transmitted to Japan and did not survive. Lin Chi Chan, when it was in Japan the first time. The first successful attempt at bringing Lin Chi Chan into Japan is what they call the Gozan School, the Five Mountain School of Zen in Japan, and this was from the other lineage, the other line in China, whose name I'm not remembering, but They were more in the, from what I understand, because apparently it's always hard to say, especially with Chan masters, because they trained usually with multiple teachers and had each individual master was different and such. But this other line was more in the Zongmi tradition. And Zongmi, his principal work was to root all of the Chan slogans and the Chan sayings of the Chan masters of his time, which was 9th century, if I believe correctly, into the sutras. So he believed that the Chan teachings of seeing into your true nature, of sudden awakening, and all of that was absolutely the, pinnacle of practice in the what he engaged in. But he was also a master of the Huayan, the Flower Garland Sutra, and that was a very almost academic group. I mean, they had their practices as well, but they spent their time investigating this very large and very intricate sutra. And so Zongmi wrote this large text that rooted all the sayings of the Chan masters, I mean, really, a big selection of them into the sutras, and he kind of divided them up into categories, and he created a very elegant system. And so this other line of Lin Chi Chan, which kind of the two lines, the Yang Chi line and this other one, split off, I think, around the 11th century, something like that. And it was this more rooted in the sutras style that first transmitted, or not necessarily first, but kind of first had a foothold in Japan and became the Five Mountains tradition. And they're much more kind of not quite esoteric, but closer to that. Their writings were more impenetrable, they were more oriented around writings, and the Five Mountains did not survive. But it lasted for a while, I'm not sure how long. 100 or 200 years. But as he Torrey notes here, only the descendants of Kanzan and then old Gudo. And Gudo, was who we completed the with yesterday, Gudo Toshoku. So he says, only the descendants of Kanzan and old Gudo still survive. And Daibi comments on this. When he was 52, Gudo was promoted to Myoshinji, and at the age of 60 was ordered by the Emperor Gomizu to give a talk from the top seat in the palace, an exceedingly rare event. On the occasion of the 300th anniversary of the death of national teacher Kanzan, founder of Myoshinji, at the ceremony for pacifying the spirits of the dead, Gudo, now 83, burned incense for the dead as the present Dharma master. In his address, he said, 24 Zen lines have come to Japan. Sadly, most have lost their transmission. Fortunately, Kanzan had descendants who continued the flame and the perfume for 300 years. Torrey refers to these words of Gudo. So there, I was in error here. When he says descendants of Kanzan, Kanzan was the founder of Myoshinji, and he was, I believe, the third patriarch in Japan. It was Kido, I believe, who actually transmitted Lin Chi Chan to Dayo. It's Master Dayo, who was the first patriarch of Japan. So, my apologies. The next section. Bunan's 3-foot-long sword slashes until nobody is left. Shoju snatched this sword after 40 years of grinding. Daibi says, Master Shido Bunan was from Sekigahara in Mino. Late in life, he left home and eventually inherited the Dharma from Gudo. I'm always maybe inordinately pleased when I see these late in life monks, since by at least these standards, I left home late at life in my 30s, where so many of these people there, the next person will be started at 16, so it's The practice takes a long time, and so the early start is, there's a lot to be said for it, but at least in our era, how many 16-year-olds or 18-year-olds or 25-year-olds are even really ready for that kind of commitment? Some, for sure, but I wasn't. While Gudo was going to and fro between Kyoto and Edo, Edo was the old name for Tokyo, he used to put up at Bunan's on his way. Thus, an affinity link was forged, and Bunan came to train under Gudo. Later, he taught in Edo. Various hermitages, such as the Shido Hermitage of Tohokuji, are connected with him. Bunan was never head of a great temple, but ended his life as the incumbent of a hermitage. But as the Shoju Rogen was one of his disciples, his Dharma line continues to this day. Teaching to his disciples, Bunin said, "Our school stresses Satori as its source. But Satori is not the end of it, and you must not stop there. You must train according to the Dharma and get to the end of the way." And so this is a very clear statement of a point that I made yesterday and throughout the discussion of the lineage, which once again goes back to Zongmi, who really stressed this teaching of the all-at-once awakening and the gradual practicing, gradual, the step-by-step practice is how he would put it. Nowadays, we put this as, we might say they're maturing at that point, but you need to have this initial breakthrough to see past all your conditioning there. And as I noted yesterday, we still have a lot of conditioning, a lot of work to do, and then you continue to practice. Hakuin, who is a Dharma heir of Shoju Rogen, Hakuin had 19 major kensho, deep insights, and he said countless minor ones. And that is this process. We'll get to his story of his initial insight, right? And like many people, he thought his initial insight was all that, but Shoju Rogen kind of leads him to the truth. And then you keep working, keep working. So this is the way of our lineage, and this is really the way of all Chan. It really developed in this way. This is why Zongmi was so influential. This wasn't his conception, right? This wasn't like he cut this out of whole cloth. This is pretty much the standard affair, in Indian Buddhism, with this long, links on the path of, step by step. They're very mapped out guidelines in the different forms and such of the different schools of Indian Buddhism. And then Zen and Chan came to have this reputation, right? It was just this big all-at-once awakening, right? And there's and Zongmi examines this. There's these four possibilities, right? That you can have all-at-once awakening, and then this kind of all-at-once practice, as he would put it, or you could have all-at-once awakening and gradual practice, or gradual awakening and gradual practice, or what am I missing? I'm missing one of them. Gradual awakening, sudden practice, right? That one I believe is not really thought to really occur, but those the four possibilities, and there's been arguments back and forth on them, right? The sudden and the gradual is a big point of discussion. There wasn't really in any of the Zen schools, even the much derided Northern school, or so-called Northern school, did not really practice a gradual awakening, gradual practice. But they were, labeled as such. Aspects of the Kaodong school and the Soto school could be said to be gradual awakening. But even in their case, it's still, you do engage in a gradual practice, and then there's still a sudden shift. All of these awakening processes are more like the evolutionary concept of punctuated equilibrium, where things kind of continue on at a baseline, and then there's a sudden shift, and then it's establishes a new baseline, and then it continues on. But this is really the what Zongmi promoted, but he got it from the Complete Awakening Sutra, which was kind of an apocryphal Chinese sutra written probably 100 years before Zhang Yi's time. But it was very important in Chinese Buddhism and in the development of Chan, because it really established this idea that we have these insights, and then that's kind of when the practice begins, right? That's when you really begin the work. And the way this developed was, it was you would have, in the koan study, for instance, you would have your big insight with a breakthrough koan. Mu being the most famous breakthrough koan, but what is the original face before your parents were born is another breakthrough koan. And Hakuin, of course, invented the what is the sound of one hand, another breakthrough koan. So you can have that initial insight, and then you work through all the other koans, which look at questions of original nature from multiple angles. And you really gain further insight into true nature. And during the course of that, you'll have, like Hakuin, these other major and minor breakthroughs. And that, you know, as my experience of doing the amount of when I was working through the koans, any teacher of note, and we talked about this a bit yesterday, when I was talking about fidelity, where teachers perhaps may or may not push their students like they used to, but you know, any teacher that's really following the Rinzai way, as you will work on Mu until you've had some insight. That initial insight is often shallow, but that is how it's done. You start in the, at least in the kind of branch of the Myoshinji lineage that I was in, you started with Mu, and you had to stick with Mu until you saw through it. And then you worked on the other koans, and the other koans, and there'll be a lot in this book about koans, but I don't think we're going to get to it for 6 months or so. But there's, as you work through them, you'll have these kind of minor insights. In fact, into most koans, you need to have a little, you know, kind of a minor insight, but there's koans that are kind of can be grouped together, and you can kind of have these insights into them. And then sometimes during the course of it, usually not while you're actually working on the koans, but at some event will trigger deeper breakthroughs, and that's just the process as we go through it. And that's why they established the koan system as they did, because it is a methodology of doing that long step-by-step practice. And this is really the thrust of this book. Torianji is grounding us here in the lineage and kind of what the school's kind of purport is. And then the rest of the book is, there's a lot of talk about what you actually do in practice from a novice on, kind of, it begins with kind of where you begin intellectually, right? Your kind of right view, and then the practices you go through it. And then he talks about things that are much less discussed, which is this practice of advanced practice. After you've completed the koan curriculum, there's still kind of further koans you work with in this advanced practice. And then there's this period of maturity. And some teachers talk about maturity a lot. It can be a big topic of discussion, but that is, I mentioned this yesterday as well, I believe in the Chan system was they expected that after you had Inca, you would then spend 30 years doing some kind of non-teaching type work. And that, that didn't always happen, even in Chan. And you certainly don't really see much mention of this in a lot of the Japanese teachers, though occasionally you'll see a person who goes and does some other work for a period of time before teaching. And we will have the Tori section on maturity to look forward to in some far distant period when I get to that. But for now, just in this section here, when he says, you must train according to the Dharma and to get to the end of the way. And of course, there is no real end to the way, but the way that is outlined by Torrey here is that you rouse the aspiration for awakening and you go through this long process, and then you at some point pass on, you give Inca to a student of your own. That is the wheel of the Dharma in this terms, what they talk about, turning the wheel. According to the Dharma means genuinely to know the true mind. To train means with right knowing and right seeing to destroy and cast away the karma hindrances. To have insight into the way is comparatively easy, but the practice afterwards is exceedingly hard. So he says, cast away the karmic hindrances. This is how I usually refer to this as conditioning. We all have the conditioning, societal conditioning, and conditioning that come from our youth. And the societal conditioning can be seen as like this previous karma. They use these terms that you kind of stored this up in past lives or whatever, but I think it's more instructive to look at that as societal conditioning, and that's the conditions that your society is in that conditions you such that you can't really even see that. Systemic racism is a good example of this. If you're a white person in our society, you can't even necessarily see your privilege, right? It's an awakening of another type to see one's privilege in this world. And this goes for many, many categories. Males as well have privilege in our society. And there's many features beyond these kind of cultural things as well that are part of the societal conditioning. And then we get the conditioning from our families and our upbringing and the friends that you have and what happened to you in school, and all this stuff just builds up these what are basically barriers between our original nature, right, that our self erects, right? Our provisional self, our illusory self, is basically made up of that conditioning. That's what it is. That's why they're not physical barriers, but there's things that is used to define this structure that we mistakenly identify with. And we kind of can't help conditioning in a certain way, right? These things happen to us and there's impressions on them. But a fully awakened person, and this would be through what the Chan masters would refer to through the prison barrier, is you no longer form attachments. So when events happen to you, you still react and you feel them, but you don't form new attachments. And that's a very different way of operating. And it's no way that I can't relate, being far from breaking through the prison barrier. But you can read occasional reports of this in one of Chan Master Xin Yang's books. He talks about these barriers and what it's like for the person through the prison barrier. And that's the condition that, what he means a fully awakened person here. And then this line where he says, to have insight into the way is comparatively easy. Now, those of us engaged in the practice might, dispute that. I mean, depending, you might not. It might have been very easy for you to have that initial, usually shallow breakthrough. There might have not been a hard thing. Actually, quite a few people have it on their first session. They'll have a shallow breakthrough. Because it's such a stress, that first session, especially if you really throw yourself into it. It's a stressor that one's not used to. I mean, I've probably related this before, but my first session I did the same year that I rode my bicycle across the country, 5,500 miles of biking over almost 4 months and camping the whole way, crossing the Cascade Mountain Range, the Rocky Mountain Range, and then in the East Coast, the tiny little mountain ranges of the Green Mountains and the White Mountains and the Appalachians. And it was incredibly hot in the Midwest, too. It was a heat wave that summer, 100-degree weather while I was in Minnesota and Indiana and Illinois. So that was hard. And then that winter, the Rahatsu Sesshin was my first Sesshin. And afterwards, I said, this is a thing I've often said. I said, this Sesshin was the hardest thing I've ever done. And I say this in the year that I biked cross country, which had its hard moments, but the Sesshin concentrated like all of that into 8 days. It was very difficult. And even though I had been sitting a lot up to that point, it doesn't compare. And this was with Choboji and the Rahatsu, as they do it. It gets longer and longer every day, right? So it's kind of a normal Sesshin hours, the first 2 days or so, and then they kind of add an hour every day until by the last day, you're sitting till midnight or so, and you're really strongly encouraged to do yaza. And then especially the last night, you know, sitting all night is really de rigueur. So, you know, it was a hard session. But as he notes here, the practice afterwards is exceedingly hard. So this sesshin, right, doing sesshin and having that initial breakthrough might seem really hard. And if one hasn't, you know, as of right now, had that initial breakthrough, it might seem almost insurmountable, impossible. You know, you just keep doing what you're doing, you're pushing yourself harder and harder or whatever, you know. All we can do is set up the conditions for this, for a breakthrough. They kind of comes through grace in the end when it happens. You know, there's no knowing. But all we do is kind of keep ourselves in alignment with our original nature, and you keep pushing. You kind of can't stop and coast. So, you know, there's a lot of things to be said on that, and I've talked about this in other talks, but in not the subject of this one, but the point we want to get at here is then the practice afterwards is exceedingly hard, right? And that's because all that conditioning still remains when you have that original breakthrough. I once heard a talk from Gwagu of the Tallahassee Chan Center where he referred to this, the Kensho process can be what in modern parlance is called spiritual bypassing. There's other kind of slower techniques that you can do, Shikantaza being one of them, where because it takes a really long time and you're really just working in your mind, you know, in silence in your mind, that you kind of get to all the dusty corners of your mind and you become aware of and see all your conditioning, and seeing it kind of lets you loosen the bonds and you can let go of some conditioning during that case as well as you work through that. You work through your conditioning over this long period of time. And even though that in that practice, the Shikantaza practice, then ultimately the realization is like the bottom falling out of a bucket, and it's this sudden process, but there's this big kind of long, a longer gradual lead up to it. Whereas you can do an inquiry practice, like koans or hwato, where you incessantly work with a question or work with something like mu, and it kind of bypasses all that work on the conditioning. Right, and this is, spiritual bypassing is generally considered kind of a negative thing, but in this case it's actually a positive because it gets you to the point where you've bypassed your conditioning into original nature, which is the essential thing to have, to be able to see is into our original nature. That's the breakthrough. And that can really fuel your practice from then on. Because even if you worked it through Shikantaza, you're not done with the condition as well, because it is at some point that the bottom falls out of the bucket and then you still go back. And so the practice, as he says, is exceedingly hard because there is still all that actual conditioning to work through. That's the hard part. And as I noted, Hakuin said 18 more breakthroughs. And it doesn't necessarily get any easier to do the breakthroughs, right? Because things like the stressor of one's first session or first couple sessions where they're really hard, and you, especially if you're pushing yourself, you know, sesshin becomes not that hard to do after a while. You can push yourself each time, but eventually there's like a limit to that, you know. There's only so many hours in the day. You can sit all night, every night, and then there's only a week, and then you're done, right? And you see that, people pushing themselves harder and harder, and they're getting much more closer to the ascetic practices at that point, which is not really the way. It's not this, it's kind of what they, when they talk about practices outside of the way, you know, the Buddhism is a middle way, which still meant fairly ascetic practices, right? So we, most of us in the West could push ourselves ascetically harder. But, you know, sleeping on a bed of nails and such is not the way, right? At least of this, of our school. So it isn't, it doesn't come down to that, right? That shock of these hard, like one's first session, these hard things, can lead yourself to kind of abandon the field, and you bypass that conditioning, and then you see into original nature. But that's not the whole process. And so with somebody like Hakuin, and most of the Chan practitioners of the and Zen practitioners since Dahui's time, they were engaged in the Hwato practice, a form of koan work, and it is how Hakuin taught that. It was codified later by his students in a different way, but it's still how we're actually taught to do koans, is this Hwato practice. And so you do that over and over again, and you keep having these breakthroughs, and you keep doing zazen, and you keep seeing your conditioning. And so eventually you kind of go through enough samadhi type practices that you're, it's the equivalent of the shikantaza practice. It's just done in a different ordering. And that is hard, and that's why he said this is hard. There's a line from Hakuin where he says, seeing into your original nature is as easy as picking up a speck of dust from the ground, right? But maturity, right, this step-by-step practice, he said that's the hard part. Therefore, Bodhidharma said that there are many who know the way, but few who walk it. One should just, day and night, brandish the treasure sword of the Vajra King and firmly and continuously kill this body. When this body is destroyed, then naturally one arrives at the great release and the great freedom. The Vajra, the sword of the Vajra King cuts through delusions, right? So when he says destroys this body, he's talking about illusory things, right? There's the illusions are, as we say in our in the four great vows, are, the delusions are endless, right? Inexhaustible. And you cut through them all with the Vajra sword, right? You work through. And that is basically this scene past one's conditioning, because that's what makes things delusory. It's our self, right? Our sense of self cast out into the world and separates ourself from all these things. And that's the delusion, right? There's no commentary made in Buddhism about whether form is empty, but whether it's still real or not, right? So they have this delusory nature. The delusory nature is the separateness and the idea that they have a fixed nature. That's what's the delusion. And so when you cut through all of that, when you cut through all of your delusions, right, when you no longer divide the world into self and other, and there's just the world, then you have the great freedom. Thus, Bunan compassionately pointed out the purpose of training. Though not depending on words in the Middle Ages in Japan, even Zen was rather apt to lapse into playing with words. But Bunan's way of teaching is straightforward and direct. And this also refers to what I discussed a bit yesterday about the ebb and flow of Zen and Chan before it. It always has points where it kind of falls into decay and then it's revived by a great teacher. And this, what he's saying is somebody, Bunan, teaching straightforward and direct and had these high standards of not passing on the Dharma to somebody who hasn't exceeded them. With the 3-foot sword in hand, first of all, kill this I. Having slashed it up, when there is not even a shadow of substance left in the whole universe, there is nothing which is not self. So of course, the great freedom and the great release are achieved. In a busy world as is today's, such a simple and apt training is most necessary. So here he is saying more explicitly what I was saying is kill this I, and having slashed it up, there's not even a shadow of substance left in the whole universe. So there's no separation, right? There's no longer this division to this I and all these other things. And so he says there is nothing which is not self, right? Because there's only at that point original nature. Shoju, the name of his hermitage, refers to Master Dokyo Eitan. He was from Iyama in Shinshu at the Tohokuji in Azabu, Edo. He had his head shaved and put on the dyed robe under Bunan, trained under him, and finally inherited his dharma. Eventually, he went back to his native Iyama, where he built the Shoju hermitage, looked after his old mother, and continued there until the end of his life. People never used his name, but called him Shoju Orojin, Old Man Shoju. In his teachings, he consistently stressed right thinking, as shown in the following excerpts from his recorded sayings. The main point is right thinking. Those who have not yet had Satori must seek a genuine Dharma teacher and firmly set their mind at it. Thus determined, during the 12 periods, which is the 24 hours of the day, and in the 4 positions of standing, sitting, walking, and lying down, they must continue without fail. In this age of the decline of the Dharma, men only strive after fame or burn for gain. Rarely does somebody show a potentiality for the way, and a man who can think rightly is hard to find. Even more so, a man who makes ceaseless effort in maintaining right thinking. Not one can be found among 1,000 or 10,000 middlings. Truly, what a difficult it is to maintain and guard is the great matter of right thinking. This old monk, at the age of 13, knew that this was so. Yet, at 16, I broke the honor of a maiden. When I was 19, I left home and trained under Master Bunan. Then for over 10 years, I encountered other poisonous hands and finally retired to this mountain. Now that I am almost 70, I stick only to the way. During the last 40 years, I have given up everything and severed all connections with the world, thus singly upholding the way. Here, over the last 5 or 6 years, I have truly awakened to the inheritance of genuine right thinking. So this stress on right thinking, right, is the view that you take on all of this matter, on the practice, on the way that you uphold the precepts, on the way that you work with the teachings of others, and I'm sure in his case, many more things, probably honoring of his previous teachers. He talks about you need to find a genuine teacher, and then he talks about later on, he says, he studied for 10 years under Master Bunan, then over another 10 years, he encountered other poisonous hands, right? So poisonous hands, right, are other teachers, right? People who are killing, right? They use this metaphor they often use in the samurai zen of the Rinzai school, right? Of killing the self, as they said in the last section. And he says here, after doing all this, right, then he then became a hermit for 40 years. And he has given up everything and severed all connections with the world, thus singly upholding the way. Here, over the last 5 or 6 years, I have truly awakened to the inheritance of genuine right thinking. Right? So he's saying that over this long period of time of just engaged in the practice, that he really kind of truly was upholding that principle that he had of right thinking, but it's in all of these ways. This is somebody as an awakened person. No, there's an interesting thing in Basui, a somewhat earlier, also Rinzai monk. He also trained with a long-term hermit like this fellow. And at one point, the person he trained with, that monk, said that he had become attached to his hermitage and took pride in his, like, I've lived alone for 40 years type of thing. And that's always a risk. And we don't have it enough, at least I've never read enough to say whether we know that about Shoju Rojin, but at least when Hakuin encountered him, he still seemed completely on, as a completely solid teacher, and his emphasis on this right thinking maybe was a guard against that kind of pride one could take in this isolation. But in general, Chan and Zen follows the course of the 10 ox herding pictures, and the last of those is, of course, to return to the village with helping hands. Now, in Buddhism, a lot of what people mistake the notion of these great compassionate acts that one can do, there's, of course, many things that one can do is great and helpful for people, but almost always what they're talking about is liberating further people. So once you become liberated yourself, the most compassionate thing you can do is help liberate other people. And so in this case, Shoju Rojin continually seemed to have students that would come to his hermitage, not like running a monastery, but on a more individual nature. And of course, Hakuin came to him, along with another student that Hakuin talks about in his autobiography. So that, I think, is knowing your nature. It's not everyone who is a great teacher, not a great teacher in a large context, but might be work well on with a one-on-one, a master-disciple situation, or like an apprenticeship type situation. And I think that's an important thing to know that, because we all still have our own style and our own affect and our own individual nature in that way. And I mean, that's something I can really understand. If you're more introverted, more inclined towards that, then running a gigantic school is not necessarily your style. Hakuin would be an example of the opposite of this guy. I mean, he did periods in a hermitage, but he seemed pretty happy to establish his temples and monasteries. Shouju snatched the sword from the hand of Bunin, yet he too, with determined effort, had to break his bones for long 40 years to be able to do so. We do well to consider that following and inheriting the way is not easy. And that certainly has been stressed over and over again in this lineage by Tore, and I think those of us who have engaged in the practice know this is true. A closed room lets in no air. The profundity of Buddha and patriarchs is fully digested. Our Kokorin, Hakuin, Tore's teacher, was caught and defeated. His whole body ached as if poisoned. So Tore here writing about his teacher, Hakuin, and he uses his Dharma name, Kokorin. Right? Hakuin is a name given to him. I'm not actually sure what Hakuin is. I don't think it's his mountain name. It might have been a posthumous name or a name given by the emperor. I mean, there's just all these different names that you can give. But as a training monk, he would have gone under Kokorin. Daibei's comment. Over 40 years, Shouju's teachings were tight like a closed room that lets in no air. The demons of other ways could not peep in. Rather, confronting the Rojin, each one was firmly plucked out and spirited away. At Takada and Ichigo, Kokorin had seen into and had penetrated Joshu's mu. Full to bursting with it, he hastened to Shouju, but on confronting him was ousted, and the proud demon of Satori had his nose broken by the Rojin. So in Wild Ivy, one of three autobiographies that Hakuin wrote, he talks about he had this breakthrough with mu, and he became very arrogant, full of himself, like, I have seen this, right? And this is, like I said, very common. It's why if you're in the monastery, you just keep practicing, right? You just keep working. Because at this point, your conditioning will bring the self back. You've transcended the self, but then the self will quickly come roaring back. And then also now think of it as an awakened being. So it's now an awakened ego, which is a recipe for disaster, right? Everyone who goes from that perspective almost always gets into trouble. There's a book called Halfway Up the Mountain that's entirely of stories of people thinking they're awake when they still have a lot more work left to do. And it's mostly about trouble that has been caused. And it's actually, I think, sometime later, you know, 6 months later or so, that Hakuin and this fellow monk traveled to Shouju and, you know, when he encountered him, of course, there was like this immediate testing, right? The kind of host and guest situation. And Shouju said, like, well, he said, what about Joshu's dog? And Hakuin said something along the lines of, he says, oh, you can't put a hand or feet on that. And Shouju said, well, put your hand on this. And he grabs his nose and like tweaks it. It says here he breaks it. I don't know. That, and then Hakuin like collapsed at that point. And apparently, I think at that point he had another awakening, like his second awakening. And then, or at least an insight into his arrogance. I can't remember the story exactly. But then Shouju gave him 8 koans at that point. He's like, answer these. And then kind of set him off. And he only trained with Shouju Rojin for like 8 months, right? So he's considered his Dharma heir and in this lineage here, but Hakuin went to half a dozen teachers. He was never satisfied with them. And then this is the one he said, like, this is the guy. So, you know, it's very different than how we think of it, even among a lot of these other people in this lineage we've been reading. Owing to this, Kokorin was assailed by violent aches all over his body, such as not even Buddha or the patriarchs can assuage. In the customs of the Chao dynasty, this ache is listed as a terrible pain usually occurring in spring and said to be caused by poison and extremely difficult to heal. However, in our context, it is not to be understood as an ordinary sickness of body or mind. Few suffer from it. So this is Hakuin's kind of famous Zen sickness that he had, of which he reportedly met a kind of another recluse who taught him this method of envisioning a pat of butter on your head and it melting down through your body. And Qigong people that I've read note that this is basically a Qigong technique. You're envisioning a chi on the top of your head and then having it wash down through your whole body. So this is like purified cosmic chi that comes in from the head and it washes through you. And Hakuin talks about in Wild Ivy, that one autobiography of his, he talks about he merged this with Zazen. So he would continue to do Zazen and also at the same time this butter melting healing technique. And this supposedly healed him. But for you, the wind of our school would have freely blown through the patriarchal gate. The airs will continue into the future without break in the harshness of training. And Hakuin was well known for being extraordinarily severe. I had a teacher once tell the Sangha that they said, you know, if you encountered a teacher like Hakuin, nobody here would stick with it, right? It would just be too harsh to a degree that, you know, few people in the modern era, because we're not tough in the same way. You know, perhaps somebody who's gone through some sort of incredibly severe military boot camp type thing would take Hakuin's style of training, but who knows? Kokurin is Master Hakuin Ikkaku. He was from Hareki in Suruga province. On leaving home, he entered Shoenji and later became its incumbent. Kokurin is another name for his temple. He inherited the Dharma from Shoju and is considered the restorer of the Rinzai Zen school in Japan. So when he says here that Kokurin is another name for his temples, that could be the temple name, and maybe Hakuin really was his Dharma name. I'm going to have to look this up on which way that goes. The Zen, which from old was transmitted through the three patriarchs, Daio, Daito, and Kanzan, so those are the three first patriarchs of Japan, is nowadays fully embodied only by Kokurin. At the present time, there are some 10 headquarter temples and a couple of dozen training monasteries. Everyone comes down from Kokurin. Now note that this is Daibi's comment, right? So he's saying in the present day, which is 1920 or whenever this is written, he's noting that nowadays fully embodied only by Kokurin, only by Hakuin. And all of the Rinzai Zen in Japan and the rest of the world where it's transmitted has all come from Hakuin at this point, all from that's the lineage, there's 10 branches of Rinzai, which the Myoshinji branch is the largest, and it says here a couple dozen training monasteries. There's a post on the One Drop site right now from Harada Roshi where he talks about the training dojos in Japan. He says there's 23 Rinzai training dojos in Japan right now, and which he says here a couple dozen training monasteries. So this hasn't changed from Daibei's time, which is only about 100 years ago. Went from 24 to 23 or so. Anyway, the post from Roshi is interesting. He talks about the expectations one would have when working that and the way a Westerner would work in the traditional Japanese monastery. So worth looking at. But anyway, he continues. Tore says, but for you, the wind of our school would have freely blown through the patriarchal gate. I.e., if it had not been for Hakuin, the school teachings would have not been transmitted as well. This is indeed in line with Rinzai's utterance. Who would have thought that my true Dharma eye would be destroyed by a blind donkey? Because of the emergence of a great master like Kokurin, the descendants will continue for a long time, and the children and their children will be made to suffer. Now daily life practice, now interviews, now Dharma talks, all are bothersome burdens to the student. Then katsu, then the stick, the continuous pressure of being scolded and threatened. Will it ever end? It may go on forever, being delivered without duress. So here he is kind of summarizing the Rinzai school. When you're in the monastery, it says, the descendants will continue for a long time and the children and their children will be made to suffer. Right, that's the way they've been putting this for a little while in this lineage, the suffering. And he says that here's the outline of a daily life practice. Now interviews or sanzins, right? So now sanzin, now teisho. All are bothersome burdens to the student. Then the katsu, so the shouts and the stick and the continuous scolding and being threatened. Right? Will it ever end? And he says, no, may it go on forever. which is saying, may our lineage last forever. One of Hakuin's Dharma heirs, Master Torei Inji, in the spring of his 29th year, lived in Kyoto near the Shirakawa River. He had contracted a serious illness. That was in the first year of Kanon, 1748, at which time he wrote the Discourse on the Inexhaustible Lamp. And impressed by the virtue strength of his master, he wrote a poem praising him and presented it to Shoinji, Hakuin's temple. And this is his poem. The rain has stopped and the distant mountains are blue. The moon shines bright and the running water is clear. The ivy clings to the well tower and pines and oaks are planted behind the river. The true transmission of Seihoku, west of the river, was correctly inherited through Nambo and Toyo. Being humbled by the Shoju Rojin, you do not lift the head, empty stomach, lofty heart. Losing the spirit and becoming discouraged, yet you cut off the living pulse of Buddha and patriarchs. Hanging the hammer on the sleeve, you pierced this monk's eye and tore out the pupil. The poisonous stone you wrap up in brocade, and not only in the 70 provinces of Japan is our true light blown out, but smashed is the treasure mirror in all the countries of the world. Seven prides and eight madnesses, sitting in a thorny thicket on the East Mountain, perturbed and confused, the 10 evils and the 5 heinous crimes. Swallowing yogis' chestnut burrs, turning revulsion. But for you, the wind of our school would have freely blown through the patriarchal gate. The airs will continue into the future without break in the harshness. Master Torei quotes from his own writings. Some of that little, you know, two lines he said on this, right? The wind blowing freely through the patriarchal gate and the airs will continue in the future without a break in the harshness, or from this poem, his own poem on Hakuin, a very effusive praise of Hakuin, but in this Zen style, right, where he kind of, you know, seems to criticize in a way that seems, that is really the, quite lauding him. In order to cut off your doubts, I have acquainted you with the line of the masters of the true transmission. What it was that all these masters inherited and transmitted, I do not know. And that's an important thing. What it was that they inherited and transmitted, I do not know. This is part of a koan that you'll be asked if you ever do the koan study, is what is transmitted. I'll leave it for you to take on that up on your koan work. The you refers to those who are in training. Zen is the Dharma gate, the teaching of transmission from mind to mind. In order to cut off any doubt, Master Torei has shown the transmission of the lamp through generations of patriarchal masters. The 27 of India, from Kashyapa and Ananda to Bodhidharma, with Bodhidharma's coming from the West, the transmission from him through to the 6th patriarch, after whom there were 23 patriarchs in China, all well known, and passing on from Rinzai to Kido, from Kido to Dayo, who brought it to our country. Then it continued from Dayo through Kanzan. So Torei showed how from one to the other, like from one lamp to 100 and to 1,000 lamps, the transmission continued. But what is the essence of our school that was transmitted from patriarch to patriarch? Torei says he does not know. But one must not carelessly overlook the significance of such a statement. The one who does not know is the one who is the most familiar. And that concludes the lineage. This chapter still has, it ends with some questions and answers, and then actually an interesting digression into one of the esoteric schools, the Shingon sect. But this is we've gone through the whole lineage up to, with Daibei's comment, Torei Inji. And this idea here at the very end, he says, the one who does not know is the one who is the most familiar. And we will conclude with that for today's talk, because always remember that the essence of the teaching, the Buddhist teachings as embodied in Chan and Zen, is one of no knowing. Ultimately, there's no knowing. There's many things that there is no knowing. And there's many things, of course, we can't explain, right? Things that we can sense and feel and kind of be a part of. The way you can just be a part of your body, you're a part of this reality, but we can't know it. We can't know it in a conceptual sense. Anything important, we can't really know in a conceptual sense. So this is the school of no knowing.